Well, we've actually had this this talk once before already, and now we're moving forward, I think. If you guys don't know, you can always look on. There's several different websites for missing persons. We have several here in Oklahoma, and one that caught my attention, and I was able to actually reach out to someone who is right in the middle of this story, because the person that came up missing is his mother and his brother. And we're going to dive into that tonight. Before I do that, real quick, I just want to thank everybody for tuning in, and I want to encourage you guys to go dive into this case. And if you have a opinion, if you have something that you want to share, reach out to me and let me know. But I'm talking about the case of Kathleen Henson and her son Royce, who was an infant at the time she goes missing. And with us tonight is Eamon, her son. How old were you at the time, Eamon, when this happened?
I was 9.
9 years old, man. What an age for your mom to just vanish.
Yeah.
You know? For those of you that don't know and have never come across this story before, it's a little surprising because there's plenty of stuff online that you can find about it. There's plenty of opinions and things. But we've got the man here with us tonight, and we're going to be making an announcement as well with this broadcast about something that we're doing with Eamon. But your mom comes up missing March 23rd, 1979, I think is the date.
Correct. Coming right up.
And, yeah, no kidding. Let's dive into her. And we'll start to peel the layers back of this onion to try and piece together what you can remember, because it was a long time ago.
Certainly.
Some of the pieces of the puzzle that we think are important for everybody to know, and even stuff that may not even be out there yet. So, your mother, she was kind of known in the Tulsa parts, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, she, she was beautiful and tall and very active on the scene. She was very much a part of the Tulsa art scene and came from parents who are very hardworking. My grandfather was a part of the Masonic Lodge. He was in the first class of the Scottish Rite here in Tulsa. My grandmother, she happened to be the first woman in the state of Missouri to pass the CPCU exam in the state on her first try. And so she was, at that time, that made her an excellent secretary,
sure,
office manager of sorts. So incredibly smart. And attractive and outgoing, she was very well known.
And it sounds like from your description of her and from what I've read, she also attended University of Tulsa for a time. Very, very smart woman.
Yeah. Yeah, well, two sides of the coin. She certainly had her dark side, but on her light side, yes, incredibly intelligent, and she tested at above 140 IQ, but flunked out of her first year at OU. She went down there right out of high school and just didn't go to class. So,
heard that story before.
Yeah, and I lived that too, so I get it. But she, you know, made efforts to correct that behavior and skipped a year and then went to TU. This really just leads right into my mother was her own person, and you'll find this thread throughout the conversation, that she was very headstrong, 1960s woman, very liberated, and she decided she wanted to have a son, but she didn't want to have any man involved. She didn't want a husband.
Yeah.
She didn't want a boyfriend. She wanted a son. So she told a couple people about that, and someone said okay. Happened to be an academic All-American, started on the, was a lineman. for the TU varsity football team. And that was in the fall of 68. I was born in May. It worked.
Yeah.
So.
It took.
Yeah. Yeah.
And aside from her educational background and growing up in Tulsa and all of that, she comes from a very solid, structured family.
Absolutely.
From what I understand.
Yes,
sir. Talk about that.
Well, you know, our family is full of dichotomy and paradox. So her parents, my grandparents, Bill and Elizabeth Higginbotham, granddad graduated basically illiterate from a Depression-era high school, graduated in 40 from McLeod, where they taught more animal husbandry than they did read and write and arithmetic.
Right.
You know, and so my grandmother, 11 years his senior, was already in, quote, in quotes, spinster age by the time they met in 1944 in Hickam Field in Hawaii during the war. He was an aircraft mechanic. She volunteered as a nurse's assistant, which she wasn't qualified for necessarily, but they were taking anybody who would come and help. And being unmarried and without children, she went. They met there. Actually, my grandmother had dated my granddad's friend a couple of times. He was a player, so good-looking guy, you know, out on the make. And
right.
So that didn't last, but they made friends through that process and fell in love. My mother was born at Honolulu General. Grandmother came from Edmund Wilkes. That was her maiden name. Edmund Wilkes Jr., her father was the lead city planner for the city of Kansas City, Missouri. He was their guy. So even through the Depression, they lived a middle-class life.
Sure.
Very smart. They were four kids. She was the oldest and graduated with honors from Mizzou.
You know, when I hear of her background and how she was, you know, raised and being a child of the 60s, it definitely tells me that so many of that generation was against a lot of the things that were going on modern day for that time. Of course, you had the Vietnam War, you had all kinds of civil rights, women's rights. There was a lot of stuff to be up in arms about.
Absolutely.
And from what you've told me, she embraced several of those causes.
Oh, absolutely. Now, women's rights, civil rights, being, you know, a fair-skinned, blue-eyed woman of that time, a lot of people wouldn't take it seriously, you know, only as a potential wife or whatever.
Yeah.
Getting back into secretary. But she rebelled against all that. You know, she was her own person. She wanted very much to be a part of the solution. You know, a lot of that came out as anger and bitterness towards the situation at hand. Some people, you know, like myself, for instance, very smart, but unwilling to get past their own issues to actually do something to lend a hand. But she went out of her way. For instance, if she saw a biker or an Indian or a black person being pulled over by the Tulsa police, she would pull up behind him and, "Why are you hassling my brother?"
Mm-hmm.
And she became infamous for that kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, she stood up for the little guy, or so, what she perceived as somebody who was being persecuted.
Right, and because of that, she built a reputation.
100%. No, yeah. She was very well known.
Yeah.
Not only, I mean, because of her then boyfriend, she didn't have a problem telling a police officer that he was a fascist.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Tell him to fuck right off.
Well, what was going on? Let's fast forward now to 1979. It's early in the year. What's going on in her life? Who's involved in her life? And what is she doing as far as work goes and with, you know, spending time with you and all of that? Just kind of give a general what's going on in her life early 1979.
Well, unfortunately, I didn't really get a lot of time to spend with her. She worked 6 days a week from 7 in the morning till 10 at night. She worked for her then boyfriend, Roger, and she ran one of his businesses. She had not graduated from TU, but ended up getting a business degree from Drawn School, which was very common at that time. Just, right over 18th in Boston, right off, was then Boulder Park, a little school for, it was a woman's school. who taught secretarial skills and business management, and just so she could get, you know, a better job instead of having to pursue a real or a more prestigious degree, she went to drawing. Basically, I think, to satisfy her parents that she was, in fact, working hard to do something different.
Sure.
So she managed one of Roger's businesses. It wasn't the first. They had a gas station over off 244 in Delaware for a little while. And then that morphed into Roger's Records, which was at Northridge, 54th Street, North Peoria, over right by McLean High School.
Right.
So she was there all the time. And I didn't really get a lot of FaceTime with her. But she had just had Royce, which was Roger's child, in October 5th of 77.
So Roger's the boyfriend.
Roger's the boyfriend,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And boss at the time.
Yep.
And so October 5th of 77, Royce was born. And I think I spent more time raising him probably than mom did. You know, yeah. That was my responsibility, to take care of my little brother.
Yeah.
So I changed his diapers. We had cloth diapers. You know,
sure.
We weren't buying, weren't buying Pampers or anything.
Right.
So I remember the slop pail in the bathroom, the bleach bucket. that's mostly what I really know about what she was involved in. I mean, there are specifics. For instance, the night she disappeared, they sold concert tickets at Roger's Records. And one of the things, she had a good relationship with radio stations around town, and she would go pick up bundles of tickets and sell them through the store. And she was dropping off tickets to another friend, Daisy, when that's what she was out supposedly doing, and would be home soon. But I was spending time with my dad that night.
Gary.
Gary, yes.
Yeah.
My grandmother, Gary's mother, Inez Running Rabbit, she had a home that she would take in girls from around town that were pregnant, that were estranged from their families. Mm-hmm. It was single, mostly high school age.
Mm-hmm.
And so around that time, my mom was a little older than that, but she moved into Inez's house to finish her third trimester and to have some place to go, estranged from her parents, my Bill and Elizabeth. So there she met Gary. And I call him Dad. He's on my birth certificate, but not my biological father. That they met there and fell in love and got married before I was born. So
When did you find out Gary was not your biological father?
And for sure, 100% factually, no. I was 28.
So you grew up, and even at the time this occurs, in your head, Gary's dad.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
But they were divorced when I was five.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but everything pretty much happens right up and down Peoria, right?
Yeah.
Gary had a business on Peoria.
It was on 15th, on Cherry Street.
You guys were living on Peoria.
Yes.
Their Rogers Records was on Peoria.
That's correct. Yeah, that was the alleyway.
So, the relationship with Gary, Dad, who you knew as Dad,
and still do.
What happens at age 28 that you find out, well, he's not my biological father?
Well, after the divorce, I didn't get to spend a lot of time with him, and then certainly after my mom disappeared, he was persona non grata to my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't really like him.
Mm-hmm.
He's an artist and a bohemian, you know, and he lived that lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, as long as he had some art supplies, maybe food was a secondary issue for him. I wouldn't imagine that was true for me necessarily, but I remember not having a whole lot. And that was true throughout my young life, you know. My grandparents being greatest generation, very working hard, middle class, you know, white Americans, you know, they didn't identify with that at all. And they understood that both my mom and Gary were in sort of rebellion against that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being the first, they were the first of the baby boomers to come around.
Right.
And, Granddad, bless his soul, had a lot of resentment, you know, towards a lot of those folks.
I mean, I'm sure.
You know, not only being somebody that served in the war, but was losing his daughter to this. By this time, she was pretty heavily involved in drugs and drinking and I don't know what else exactly, but both of them, And my dad wasn't that guy, you know, and I'm sure that's part of why they divorced. Mm-hmm. But being a stay-at-home dad, mom worked, and he worked on his art. And he was really my best bud. And I'm not sure what happened, but I just came home one day not unaware of any issue whatsoever, and they were divorced, and he was gone, and that was it.
Yeah.
That seems to be another theme that has happened pretty repeatedly. You know, when something changes, it happens all of a sudden, as right. much like the disappearance. So yeah. I just come home one day, and things are completely different. So getting back to your question, my grandmother would get a little, she liked gin, so she would get a little bit of a buzz on, and she might say something offhand like, well, he's not your real father, but then refuse to elaborate.
Right.
So, and I was a kid, and I didn't understand it, and I just thought they just didn't really like the guy. But, I mean, this had bothered me throughout the years, and
sure.
finally, and I was in sort of a state of depression, I cornered him, Gary, one day and said, are you my real father? Of course, he was pretty hurt by the tone and the all of the sudden, you know, yeah. well, not, I'm not the biological donor, if that's what you mean. But, and I could see he was visibly hurt. It hurt me to see him that way.
Yeah,
I'm starting to cry, and he said, why are you crying? I said, because I was very proud of my Shawnee heritage. I'm not Shawnee anymore.
Right.
So he comes over, and yeah, well, he comes over and said, that's really not how that works. You know, he never really thought of things as biological, of course.
Right.
And it's a spiritual deal for him, so.
And he did help raise you.
Yes, he did.
So, you know, he's obviously, you know, been devoted to your well-being. And
well, throughout that time, I've had some resentment towards him.
Yeah.
Not being around.
Right.
When my mom disappeared, there had to be an emergency judgment about whether who was going to get custody. Was it my dad? My mom had written a will that would have put me with her best friend, Becky. I call her Aunt. It's Aunt Becky, right? Just like Dad is Dad. But she never had that. She never took it to a... It wasn't legal. She never filed it with court. So it wasn't binding. My grandparents sued my dad for custody. He didn't fight it. And just being in that room and seeing his face at that time, mm-hmm. it really just disturbed me.
Would he have been able to to handle it?
No.
So it was the right move.
I think so. For them and for me, probably.
Yeah.
But as a child, and you see that sort of right. like him kind of backing off and being hurt but not standing up and saying anything, I was more upset about that. Yeah. He didn't fight.
Right.
And believing him to be my biological father, not knowing the difference, really, at that time.
Yeah.
You know, what does that mean? No, he's my dad. Right. Who cares?
Right.
And so, you know, throughout my 20s, I was teens and 20s, obviously upset by this. So, but he had a shop, which was an antique store. I put that in air quotes. Antique store, which was like a lot of rusted old farm equipment and beat up, broken, bent tubas and a couple of... the veneer peeling off of the violin.
He was a man before his time, because now they're everywhere.
They're everywhere.
Yeah.
But he also, it was sort of a co-op. You know, mm-hmm. he had musicians on Friday and Saturday night, and there was no charge at the door. It was donations only, and they made sandwiches in the back.
Right.
I remember going, because they got this really good sarsaparilla, and I would be able to have one, and I would bug him for a second or even a third. Eating into the profits, of course,
right.
or whatever, you know,
right.
to pay back, you know, because they were there trying to make rent. I happened to be at the shop the night my mom disappeared. So when I got home at midnight, 9 years old, you know, and I often walked there and walked home.
It was close enough that
it was a mile and a half.
A normal thing.
It was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the 70s.
Sure.
And I would walk a mile and a half at midnight home on a Friday and Saturday night. It just so happens that my dad took me home that night.
So let's before we get into that night, let's set the stage for what's going on with your mom and where Kathleen is at the time, because the days leading up, she's working at Rogers Records, the record store.
Mm-hmm.
She's come in possession of some concert tickets that she's going to take and deliver to someone's house.
To Daisy, yeah.
And Royce is with her.
That's right.
He's there with her, and I believe they have your grandfather's vehicle.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, well, she had, there was a tertiary vehicle, so okay. It was hers to use.
Right.
At that time.
Right. And you're with Gary, so you're not with her. Did you see her at all that day?
I don't believe so.
So, as she is getting ready to go on this delivery where she's going to, you know, drop some tickets off at a...
If I'm not mistaken, it was a Friday.
At a residence,
so I would not have seen her. Perhaps in the morning.
The notes that I have is that it was around 11:30 at night. Mm-hmm. So, about the time you're walking home, she's getting on the road, probably with the intention, and we don't know, but probably with the intention of dropping those tickets off and then taking herself and Royce home where you're going to be.
Yeah.
Right? But she never arrives.
Correct. She would have been home before I got home.
She would have
been home. She was always home. For all of her faults, she was never not home.
Yeah.
I knew there was something terribly wrong when I got home and she wasn't there.
So...
But I assume, and I don't know this to be true, that she hadn't made it home all day, that this was her last thing to do before she came home.
Yeah.
So that she had been at work all day.
And you don't know this until later, of where she was supposed to be or what she
correct.
Was supposed to be doing.
This is,
you're just, it's a normal day.
Post
you're
facto, just,
yeah.
for sure.
And so instead of walking home that night, Gary says, jump in, I'm going to take you home.
Yes.
And it's around midnight.
Yeah.
You get home. Nobody's there. What do you do?
Well, Gary was concerned, but me being stoic, much like my mother.
At nine?
Yeah. Well, and just, you know, I knew something was wrong. But, I just kind of dismissed. He was concerned. I said, no, it's okay. You know, I went up to the door. The door was locked. So I walked back to the car and just said, no, I can get in. He's like, are you sure? I'm like, yeah. Not a problem. So he goes. And I climbed up the eaves and climbed in my bedroom window. I knew that it was unlocked. I mean, all the time, it's weird. Intuition and irrationality live in the same block, you know. Mm. And so you never really are certain. One is not. I wasn't sure. Whether this was just a feeling or whether this was something truly, you know, disturbing. And so it wasn't until I woke up the next morning and she still wasn't home that I knew something was wrong.
When you get into the house, you don't notice anything strange.
No.
Everything's where it should be.
It was left like it was.
There's no broken windows.
I had come home from school and spent some time at home.
Yeah.
Which I normally did and was usually alone. I mean...
You walk from school, ride the bus.
Bus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Which dropped me off right out front.
So you get into the house, obviously, you know, upstairs in your bedroom, but you eventually, do you go walking around
the
house?
I went downstairs immediately.
Yeah.
I got in and I went down looking, see if maybe, you know, she was asleep, didn't hear me knocking on the door. The door wouldn't have been locked if she was home. But, you know, just to see, to be sure. And I knew something was wrong at that point. I mean, I really did. It wasn't until the next morning that I was certain.
But you don't make a phone call or anything to anyone. You just go back to your room and...
Well, I cried myself to sleep. Mm.
So the gut feeling that you had was that strong?
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, she was never not home.
You can remember that.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely, no. It was terrifying.
Do you think there was something with her... that made you feel that way, or was it just simply because she wasn't there and she was always there?
That's correct. She beat the second one. She when I say never at home, there were plenty of times that I've spent most of my life unsupervised, and so I know what that's like. But there's also, I always had a sense of security around her specifically that I always would know, like, if she's going to be out of town for the weekend, well, I always had some place to go, like with my grandparents or with Becky or with Daisy. Sometimes I stay with Daisy.
Right.
And that was always talked about ahead of time. And she was very persistent about, you know, where I was and what I was doing. You know, her ideas are pretty liberal about, you know, what can a 9-year-old do, but I think probably more mature then than I am now in a lot of ways.
Do you think she knew that that day you were with Gary?
Yeah, of course she knew.
Yeah, so she, so it was normal.
Absolutely.
She knew that.
Yes.
And so
that was a regular thing for me.
Right.
To spend the weekend each Friday and Saturday night, sometimes just one, but I would spend, I would go up to the shop and hang out with him.
So you're home alone, and obviously you have a feeling something's not right. Eventually, exhaustion and, you know, the day takes over, and you fall asleep. It's probably impossible to know, but at some point, the next day, the next morning, you awaken, and no one's
there.
Home. What do you do?
Break everything in sight.
So you went into a
rage. Absolutely. I mean,
did you think she had left you, or did
no,
you think something bad had happened?
I knew something bad had happened. It's an overwhelming sense of tragic loss. Going back to, you know, she was never not there. I mean, there were plenty of times that I spent alone, but she always said she'd always be where she said she was going to be, when she said she was going to be. She was late for work almost every day. I was late for school almost every day. There was a lot of irresponsibility going on, but it wasn't anything like to that extent. And we had a bond that was pretty special. So,
was it? I think I'm trying to think of the proper term. Was it like a feeling of like an internal connection to her, and that's why you felt that way, or was it?
I knew I'd never see her again.
So, Do you think that feeling came from her?
Well, certainly from the family. I mean, we were very, stoic, but in another sense, very psychically connected.
Right.
You know, there have been weird things that have happened amongst us. We have that connection.
Yeah.
You know, when I woke and she wasn't there, there was a part of me that just understood that I was never, ever going to see her again. And that's why I went into the rage. Crying, screaming, breaking things. It took me a minute to collect myself enough to call her mother and my grandmother and tell her that Kathy's not here. I don't know where she is. Will you come and get me?
Was that, do you remember if that was in the morning?
It was in there first thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably one or so before I fell asleep, finally.
Mm-hmm.
Just worn out.
But you said that you had that feeling prior to even going to sleep and waking up. So you, so that night you
I had an inclination.
Yeah.
That something very, very. I mean, I knew something was wrong.
But
the extent when I went to sleep, when I got home and she wasn't there, I knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
But to the extent of which it did not become real to me until the morning.
So you
when she still hadn't shown up. It was confirmed.
Right. So once you get your head wrapped around, you know, what you think is going on, or
able to breathe and calm down enough,
you make a phone call. You call your grandparents. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
Well, Granddad was out of town. He was a long haul truck driver. Elizabeth was home, and she came and picked me up.
And from that point on, it was
triage.
That was it.
Yeah.
It was time to
spend
the rest of your life trying to wonder or figure out or even just fathom what was taking place.
Right.
Because in this type of case, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but, in this type of case, you don't have anything to, you don't have a body, you don't have a crash site. You
right.
Don't have, there's none of that.
And at the time, it was a 72-hour window before the Tulsa police. They didn't have a missing person department. There was no protocol for this type. You know, if they were gone, they went crazy, or they were already dead, or whatever. So
they just decided to run away.
Exactly. Just moving on to a new life. Exactly. And I'm sure that there are plenty in power or position of authority, that would prefer that over what really happened. You know, she probably just ran off. I mean, she was known to be, you know, out there. So.
And that's easier for law enforcement to handle.
Right.
Just write it off. Look, kid, here's what happened. Your mom ran away. She's just gone.
We don't know.
Yeah. And the not knowing is the worst part. But for you, it's not just your mother.
Right.
It's your
brother
little brother.
Too. And a seeming just lack of interest at all. I didn't know most of what I know now about the way she lived her life, the relationships that she had, good, bad, or indifferent, with the, you know, the Tulsa Police Department, for instance, and with the people around her, the nature of her boyfriend's business, what she was really doing for them, what her remit was for that organization. I didn't really know any of that then.
Yeah.
And this was all brought to bear over time.
Right.
Unfortunately, I didn't know how to deal with any of it. You know, we don't expect nine-year-olds to, and they might have some pretty clear and clean intuition about what the ultimate truth is, but how to deal with that and live, you know, with this knowledge, not something that I had anyway. So one of the first things that I did, of course, was go into complete denial. She's coming back.
Right.
Even though there was a half of my brain that was saying, half of my soul, I knew that I'm never going to see her again, but the living part couldn't go on without the hope that she was going to return any minute now.
Right.
I lied to the people that I went to school with, saying she's on a business trip in Dallas. They were wondering why grandma's bringing me to school now. Mm-hmm. Why am I on time every day?
So who makes the call to the police department? Obviously your grandparents, right?
Yes.
And so there's a... is there a 72-hour period that goes by? Because eventually, and we can get into this now, her vehicle is found.
Yes.
Awkwardly parked, basically in the road, and it doesn't seem to have any... There's no mechanical issues.
Right.
It's not torn up.
It was parked the wrong way.
Parked the wrong way.
Away from the road. The tire not turned to the curb.
And Royce's stuff is in it.
The diaper bag and her purse are in it.
Right. If this had been a robbery, they would have taken her purse.
You would think.
For sure. So if it was a complete stranger walking up, they would have said, you know, give me the money.
Or if it was some other form of emergency. Right. She still would have taken the purse and the diaper bag.
And if the car had broken down, she would have taken the purse.
Of course.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're talking about where the car was found. It would have been a bit of a walk, but doable.
Sure.
To get home.
Yes.
Right? And so the Tulsa Police Department, do they find the vehicle before that 72-hour period goes past?
I'm unclear on that.
Yeah. I think they do. And at some point, the vehicle is returned to your grandparents' house. Mm-hmm. So they have the contents of the vehicle. There's no blood.
Right.
There's no crime scene there that you could think
nothing
of.
Nothing you would call.
Unlike today, where they would go nuts on the car, probably.
You would think, potentially. Yeah.
Back then, it was just, come get your car.
Yeah, more or less.
And that's what they did.
Exactly.
So, at some point, now it's got to be turned over as a case of something's happened to this woman and this child. What was the Tulsa Police Department's involvement with your grandparents, and what was that relationship like trying to determine what happened?
Well, I wasn't a part of that at all. I got piecemeal information from my grandparents as they received it, which, as I've come to understand, was next to nil. So, like I said, immediately we go into triage. They're just, you know, my grandparents lost a daughter and a grandson to this, so they were equally traumatized. Me being what I feel like as a child, sort of the only victim, you know, I reached out to them for help, but I don't necessarily even recall what that was like emotionally. I feel like I would immediately just shut down. But we came to learn that basically nothing was being done. Absolutely nothing. Based on the relationship, as I understand it, that she had with the Tulsa Police Department, they weren't really interested. At least the powers that be. For instance, Stanley Glanz, was the lead homicide detective. I know that he was not very fond of her. I know that he knows what Roger did and just consider
as far as
for his businesses. Yes,
yeah. What he was involved in.
Correct.
And we'll get into that in a minute, but I don't want the audience to think of what he did as right. what he did to her.
Right.
We'll get to that.
We assume, yeah. but we don't know.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm referring only to his businesses, the way he made his living.
So Glanz was aware of all of that.
Of course. Yep. Oh, absolutely. He was a wanted man, as it were.
Right. And as time begins to move forward, as it does, the case gets more distant and distant from when it occurred. And now
it started as a cold case.
Right.
It never really developed from that other than to colder.
There's no eyewitness that's ever come forward.
Correct.
That said, I saw her in the car, get into another car, or anything like that.
We got some information that said that she had called Daisy and said she was on her way to bring the tickets.
She was going to Daisy's residence.
Correct.
Yeah.
To drop off some tickets.
Yeah.
But that's the last that we, and that was really all that we knew. And had ever learned about it. So really, you know, I just sort of retreated into my grandparents' home, and it was just all I could do to get to the end of, that was my the end of my fourth grade year. And I was, at the time, I was at Burroughs. Mm-hmm. And honestly, by the time we got to the fall semester, where I started at Patrick Henry, that next fall was in the district that my grandparents lived in, I tried my very best to start fresh and just rebuild. And I didn't really ever talk about my mother or what had happened, and just went on my life as if it never happened.
Did your grandparents, did you ever overhear conversations or hear them talk about what they thought might have happened?
Maybe. Certainly.
I mean, there had to have been two or three different scenarios that they're trying to play out in their heads to figure out. Because she was having issues with the boyfriend,
sure.
Roger.
Yes.
And they thought maybe this was how she gets her clean break, and that they're going to get a phone call at some point.
Certainly. Well, I think that was the hope, that there had been some sort of, there had been, you know, some sort of critical mass in which the decision had to be made for her to just get out. She was... It happened so fast. She was in the car. She was with Royce. She had the opportunity and took it. And that she would just let us know later when she
right.
made it safe to wherever she was.
Right.
But I think that always, that was just sort of the blind hope.
And days turn into weeks.
Of course.
Weeks turn into months.
Uh-huh.
And I know that from the material that I have and what I've read, I know that Kathleen's sister,
Patricia,
mm-hmm. Tragically dies
Six months later.
Right.
Yes.
So it's just a triple whammy for your
yes,
grandparents.
Absolutely. Yeah, 75% of their kids basically died within 6 months.
That's probably the most difficult year you could imagine.
One, yeah. We're still living,
yeah.
you know.
Right.
Yeah.
So... As time's moving on and details of the case become blurry, you know, time does that to memory,
mm-hmm.
you begin to think about or try and, you know, piece some things together as an adult.
Sure.
And I can't imagine, I'm sure that every time somebody on the news said, human remains were found today in Mohawk
right.
Park.
Yes, of course.
You've got to go, what, is this it?
Well, right around the Orange Sox happened around that time. The campfire murders happened around that time.
Yeah.
There was a lot to be concerned about. And, you know, I mean, we lived in a pretty naive world until something like that happens, and then become hyper-vigilant. I became hyper-vigilant over stuff like that, you know, and... So there was always that sort of in the back of your mind. There could be the most irrational leap. Oh, maybe that's her. Or maybe that's, you know. My aunt and I went to visit a shaman. And he indicated, you know, through the ceremony, that she would be back. That she was in a car heading west. We knew some of Roger's family to be in California. And that he said, she'll be back. So there was still a lot of speculation that, you know, this wasn't over and that she would just sort of show up any day now.
The shaman said she was alive.
Yes.
And would return at some point.
Yes.
But those types of things you take with a grain of salt.
Well, certainly.
Because you've lived it for so long, you don't...
Well, this was later that year.
Oh, so you were still young.
Yeah, 79 or early 80 when we went to visit. I think it was the fall of 79. But fast forwarding to 1984, we had still, as a family, had not heard anything from the TPD about my mother's case. No leads, no nothing. Grandparents hired a private investigator who had some interesting ideas and some leads, but they ran out of money. Couldn't afford him anymore, so that was dropped.
Right.
1984, grandmother gets the attention of somebody at Tulsa World or Tulsa Tribune, and they wrote a story about Kathleen and bring it back into the front of our minds and get it out to the public. Has anybody seen anything? What's going on? And what they were able to glean from the TPD is that her case was still in the inbox and that nothing had ever really been done.
Right.
No papers actually even filed. No action items, no memorandums, no clear orders from anybody to anybody that anything had ever really been done to follow up on what had happened to her.
And we can only speculate as to why that is.
Correct.
But just from the outside looking in, it's not hard to connect the dots to say, look, the authorities knew her, knew who she was involved with, and said, hey, that's what happens.
She got what she deserved.
That's what happens when you run with that group.
Exactly.
And no, so
that's where we draw those conclusions from.
Right.
So
with no evidence of that, but that's where the brain goes. That's where the mind goes.
There's so very little evidence of anything,
right,
in this case, and that's part of the thing that's so frustrating.
Yeah. At some point, you submit some DNA. 2008, I think.
That
it
is
was.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Was it 2007, 2008? President Bush asked for funding, I don't know if it was an executive order, if this went through Congress or not, to fund the CDC and the Center for...
CODIS,
right? Yes, for children,
yeah,
for abused and neglected children, or whatever. To start identifying remains, to doing DNA matches to remains in morgues throughout the country. They called it as a modern-day Holocaust. There were, to their estimation, over 5 million separate cases of which there were unidentified remains in morgues throughout the country. And so they sent out a group of people that worked with the police departments in each municipality to approach people who had missing relatives.
Mm-hmm.
To collect DNA, and so it was my mother. They came to me, and I did a cheek swab. Homicide detective Maggie Lovell at the Tulsa Police Department at that time came with a CDC representative, and they did a cheek swab with me to try to match my mitochondrial DNA with my mother.
Right.
Nothing ever came of that, but at that time, and Lori Fulbright had done a story recently also, 2006 or 2007, that aired on the local news, just to bring it back to light again. This is something that has happened sort of every so often,
right,
kind of popped up again. Bring it back to the public consciousness. Has anybody heard anything? Can we get anybody who knows something to step forward and provide information that heretofore unknown?
And for you today, one of your motivations isn't necessarily to know where your mother is, but one of your motivations is to know what happened with Royce, and is he still possibly alive?
Certainly. Well, I think that is the place that holds the most hope for me.
Right.
I don't think there was ever any real place in my heart that said, she's probably still out there. Of course, there was hope. Of course, there was want. Of course, there was need. Some prayers that she was, but ultimately, since Royce was Roger's son and only a year and a half old at the time, that there would have been no need to harm him. and that he, and we actually heard, I'm not sure from where or from at what time, that this was also a running theory with some of the people at the Tulsa Police Department.
And we didn't touch on this, so we can do it now. Her boyfriend, Roger, is African American.
Yes.
And so Royce is a mix, half white, half yeah. black. And in fact, the photo that they've used for him several times, it's a black and white. You can't really tell what race he might be.
Right, right.
But
one of the things that the CDC did when they came to do the mitochondrial is they also did some mock-ups, what Kathleen would look like today, mm-hmm. what Royce might look like today. They offered me, they narrowed it down between two pictures, one that might have looked more African and one that looked a little bit more white. But he looked white to me, you know, as a child. I mean, he was a white kid. Sure. He had brown eyes, but he was Caucasian.
Yeah.
Roger's grandmother was white, so it's not unusual.
Right.
And I picked the one that I said that looked like more like him. It just happened to be a more white caricature. But they picked the other one anyway. And they put it on the, you know, on the. I was at DHS, and years later, this was in 2012, 2014, and I saw something across the room. I couldn't identify it from where I was, so I just walked right to it. I mean, almost stepping over chairs to get to it, and it was that picture on the wall. Have you seen these people? And that was the first time I'd ever seen it. Right. Since they gave me the pictures to look at.
What was that moment like?
Oh, it was heartrending. You know, what do you do?
Right.
It was just unusual to me that I could have picked it up from that far, because I clearly could not see it from where I was. I was, you know, 50 feet from it. I've got good eyesight, but...
Well, one of the things that I found very interesting about this incident, this case, is Roger's connections and what he was doing here in Tulsa. He was part of a group that was known to run and sell drugs.
Yes.
And obviously he was funneling some of that money into businesses that he had operated. But for the most part, I think it's safe to say that because of his activities, like you've said before, Tulsa Police Department knew who he was.
Of course.
And there's a possible connection to the Kansas City Mafia.
Yes.
Which is, if you don't know, when we say Mafia, we got to be careful with that, because there was a Kansas City Black Mafia
mm-hmm.
that operated out of Kansas City.
Yeah.
And in fact... several of the higher ups had relocated to Oklahoma at one point.
Yes.
So it's not a far stretch to think that he was possibly connected to them in some way. And as we know about these organized crime groups, getting rid of someone is, you know, it's part of the business
part
sometimes.
Of the deal, yes.
Yeah. So what have you thought about that over your time, you know, reviewing all the information, knowing what you know? Do you feel that that's could potentially be one of the answers here?
Well, that's sort of my operating theory. Mom came home with black eyes. She twice had her jaw wired shut, which was violence she attributed to him. She made threats privately about him, you know, if such and such ever happens again, well, he'll find out who I am and what I'm about. But that never happened, and so it wouldn't be a very far leap to attribute that he was responsible for that, and that's what I believed my whole life, that he was directly responsible for her disappearance.
And so if you look at, you know, three possible scenarios, one being, you know, Kathleen and Royce were kidnapped, okay? Another being Kathleen and Royce ran away.
Yeah.
And another being murder.
Mm-hmm.
Everything kind of, the needles kind of pointing towards the latter.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you, you feel that was definitely in the wheelhouse for Roger. He was capable of it.
Absolutely. We'll have to dig into that further with other people who know more and are better about that sort of thing, but that was, at some point, communicated with us, that was his MO.
What was your relationship like with Roger?
Oh, fractious at best. All of my dad, and seeing her with somebody else, or somebody, especially somebody who was abusive, was very difficult. I did not like the guy. I was competitive with him, even at 9. I remember going bowling once. I was telling him, I bowled before. I'm going to kick your ass.
Right.
Oh, and of course, I got my butt kicked. I think I got 60. I think he rolled a 200 that day. And I was just livid, so upset, embarrassed,
Roger's involvement, not just in your life and in your mother's life, you're forever connected because of Royce and so, because of what's taking place with your mother.
Absolutely.
And so for you as an adult now, when you go over all the information and you're within your own thoughts, what's your gut tell you?
Well, what I believe is that Roger and Kathleen had a falling out, the details of which I'm completely unaware of, and that he happened to come out on top, being in a position that he was in. He only had a certain recourse, that they did that. That Royce was taken into his custody, and that he was relocated to remember the members of his family, to be raised by somebody else, by a grandmother or a cousin or what have you. He said had relatives in Kansas City and California that we know of, and other places as
Chicago.
Well.
Chicago.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't. It's very difficult not to want to get into specific speculations over I'd heard all kinds of crazy things, like that she was planning a break and had stole some product from him in order to finance it, and then got found out. Or somebody else in the organization stole some product and brought her to believe that it was her. I've heard all kinds of stuff. But because of her relationship with Roger and the type of business that he was in,
and then
it's the most obvious,
right,
to me,
right,
which maybe is far from the truth as anything, but
April of 2013, there is a passing of Roger, who had evidently changed his name.
Mm-hmm.
And so his passing kind of marks a chapter that kind of closes the chapter on someone who potentially knew all of the answers.
Absolutely. Even if he hadn't been involved in it directly.
Absolutely. And so now the quest is not necessarily to try and convict this person of something nefarious. The quest is now to figure out, is Royce still alive?
Correct, yes. I think, God bless him, Roger is, has to deal with his maker now. And that's not up to me. And I'm not sure it ever was. But at this point, and even before Roger passed, I think the goal was just to try to bring as much peace to the survivors as possible. And one of those things, the most important one to me, is to identify whether Royce survived, and if so, if he's still alive. And if that's the case, then where is he?
Yeah, where is he? That's the question.
Yes.
And for those that don't know, because we've not said anything yet, so you shouldn't know, that's the question that we're going to try and answer. So I'm teaming up with a couple of producers here in Tulsa, and we're going to team up with a homicide detective and a psychic, and we've got some other people that we're trying to get lined up, and we're going to try and get Eamon here an answer on what's taking place with Royce. Is he out there somewhere? And you guys can really be a part of that by checking our social media pages. We're going to post the photos and everything. And I've even got the age progressed photos. Yes. We're going to post all of that, and I encourage everyone to grab it and share it on your page, because you never know. You never know who you're connected to, where they're at. You may have someone who has seen this person. And if so, you could be part of this effort. So we're going to document all of this as we go. And we should be producing a full-fledged documentary, and hopefully we can get this wrapped sometime here in 2024 and have it out for everybody to see in 2025. But obviously this is one of those stories that's just a head scratcher, and it doesn't make sense, right? The mother of two vanishes. Why? There's no trail. There's no nothing. There's no evidence. There's nothing to tell us what happened. So this is really a moonshot. I mean, this is really like we're taking a stab here, and we're just throwing the spear in the ocean and hoping we hit something. But you felt like it was time.
Oh, absolutely. And with the support of people like you, I'd like to mention others, Mike Huff, Margaret Lovell, people who throughout the years have come around and just said, hey, we haven't forgotten. She was a wonderful, kind, and loving person who, you know, through her own choices, got mixed up with some bad characters. We all live a life, and even bad characters, you know, have souls. And you know, we have to acknowledge that, you know, we're all God-made and have a place in this world. And this isn't about assigning blame or trying to figure out who did wrong. Of course, this was an orchestra of F-ups, and we just want to find Royce and to bring him home.
Well, we're excited that we're going to get to be part of this journey with you, because if, by the grace of God, we can help put some type of a closure or some type of a period on this for you, we certainly want to do that. And I know that everyone that I've spoken to that wants to be involved in this project, I know they feel the same way.
Certainly.
And I think it's safe because he's already committed, but homicide detective from the Tulsa Police Department, Jason White, is going to be a part of this. If you've ever watched The First 48, so there's a TV show called The First 48. They film it here in Tulsa and some other places, but Detective White is constantly on there. And what's amazing today about Tulsa homicide, they have like a 98% solve rate.
Yes.
It's just insane how good they are these days.
I would like to mention that my mother's case has, if anything, has come from that, is that Tulsa police added a missing persons division, that they have shortened the protocol to almost immediate if something, they feel like something terrible has happened. So if anything, certainly her life and the life of Royce and all of ours that have survived this have had an impact on the way the Tulsa police handle their business, and we are grateful.
Well, and I think we're going to see, obviously this is not 1979 anymore. This is 2024.
Yeah.
So
sure. Yeah.
the expectations should be that things are better today than they were in 79. And I believe that they are, and I think they can be a big help for us.
100.
So here's what we're going to do. Again, I encourage everyone, go on the social media pages, steal the photos from me, go post them to your page or share the page, share this broadcast. Let's see if we can't get some information rolling in whether it's local here in Tulsa or who knows, maybe somebody out in California knows something, and we would love to hear from you. Any last thoughts?
No, I'm just incredibly grateful to be a part of this process. It has been a difficult road, but finding that there are people, entities, including the Tulsa Police Department, including everyone who's been a part of this and is willing to come in at this point, I'm very, very thankful, and I thank you.
Well, I told you I wasn't going to green light this unless you were on board 100%, and you are, and you're giving us the green light.
Absolutely.
And we're ready to roll.
I need it as much as anybody else.
Well, let's see what we can do.
Absolutely, let's do it.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for us. We will get you some information soon. Check our pages, and that'll do it. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in.